So think about what happens when a painting just, refuses to let you look at it comfortably.
Right, it's jarring.
It really is.
Yeah.
Because usually when you walk into a gallery, art acts like this perfectly clean window that you just look through to find beauty. You expect technical virtuosity that kind of dazzles you.
Beautiful colors, smooth lines.
Exactly. Colors that wrap around you therapeutically. And frankly, you expect the artwork to just leave your moral compass alone.
You don't expect to be interrogated by watercolor.
No, you don't. But today, we're looking at a painting that basically shatters that glass. It looks you right in the eye and essentially demands that you check your ethics at the door before you even take another step.
It forces a confrontation, absolutely. And the piece we're unpacking in this deep dive is a watercolor titled No Looses by the artist Gyro Duke.
It's quite a piece.
It really is. Our source material today is a highly rigorous, critical, and aesthetic analysis of the specific painting. And the work, directly and honestly very confrontationally, tackles the deeply entrenched tradition of tauromachia, which is, bullfighting.
Right.
And what we are going to dissect today is this intense, often really precarious tension between delivering a crystal-clear moral manifesto and, maintaining that elusive, mysterious quality that makes art, art.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because if you want to understand how a single image can attempt to dismantle a centuries-old cultural tradition, you cannot just look at the canvas itself.
No, you have to look at the context.
Right. You have to look at where the artist was physically standing when they painted it. It turns out the actual geography of a critique changes the DNA of the critique itself.
That is so true. The technical sheet for No Looses gives us a really crucial starting point here. This piece wasn't painted, in the shadow of a Gran Plaza de Toros in Madrid or Bogota or Mexico City.
Nowhere near them.
Exactly. It was meticulously created in an independent studio in Whittier, California.
Whittier, California. I mean, on the surface, that sounds like a completely random piece of trivia.
It does.
But in the context of tauromachia, that geographic location creates this massive, almost gravitational distance from the epicenters of the tradition. The artist is surrounded by palm trees and strip malls, not the dust and the noise and, like, the heady cultural weight of the bullring.
What's fascinating here is how that physical distance functions as a protected ecosystem.
A protected ecosystem. I like that.
Yeah, because when an artist is operating locally and independently in Southern California, they are entirely removed from the hegemonic art markets of Europe or Latin America. They are stripped of that local cultural inertia.
Right. There's no pressure from the locals.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There is no societal pressure from peers who grew up attending bullfights on Sunday afternoons. It completely isolates the phenomenon, allowing the artist to examine the spectacle of the bullring with this cold, really critical clarity.
That's like stepping outside the bubble.
Yes, and there is a layered irony in this too. This razor-sharp critique of a historic Hispanic tradition of animal domination is emerging from the American West.
Which has its own baggage.
Oh, totally. A geography absolutely saturated with its own heavily romanticized mythology of cowboys, rodeos, and just the conquering of the natural world in general.
Right, that American West connection is fascinating. But doesn't that massive distance raise a huge red flag regarding the authority of the artist?
How do you mean?
Well, I mean, trying to deconstruct the visceral, blood-soaked reality of the bullring from a quiet, climate-controlled studio in California, it feels a bit like trying to describe the sheer terror of a Category 5 hurricane from inside a soundproof bunker.
Ah, I see what you're getting at.
Yeah, does this extreme asceticism actually disconnect the artist from the truth of the phenomenon? It really makes you wonder if a definitive, authoritative judgment on a culture can authentically be made from what is essentially an ivory tower thousands of miles away.
That's a very fair critique. And the source material actually addresses that exact friction.
Oh, it does.
Yeah, the argument is that the distance doesn't create an ivory tower of ignorance. Instead, it creates the necessary vantage point to see the architecture of the violence rather than getting, caught up in the raw emotion of it.
Okay, that makes sense. Stepping back to see the whole board.
Exactly. And this isn't just a theoretical distance either. The artist mechanically translates that geographic detachment directly into the physical composition of the painting itself.
Wow, into the paint itself.
Right. It literally dictates how your eye is allowed to move across the canvas.
So, if distance isolates the culture, how does the artist actually paint that isolation? Because you don't just, like, paint a map of California. You have to weave that critical distance into the visual reality.
Right, it has to be aesthetic.
Yeah. And to see how No Lucis accomplishes this, we really have to contrast it with how traditional bullfighting demands to be seen.
Yeah, right? Definitely. I mean, the aesthetic spectacle of the traditional bullfight is basically a masterclass in weaponizing human attention.
Weaponizing attention, that's a strong way to put it.
But it's true. Our brains are biologically wired to be drawn to high contrast, brilliant light, and intricate detail. And the matador's uniform, the Traje de Luces, literally the suit of lights, is meticulously designed to exploit this biological wiring.
It's basically a giant, shiny lure.
Exactly. It is heavily armored in gold embroidery and reflective sequins. It catches the afternoon sun and demands absolute visual dominance in the ring.
You just can't look away.
You physically cannot take your eyes off the matador. He is the brilliant, shimmering center of the universe out there on the sand.
But in the watercolor, the artist completely inverts this visual hierarchy. He takes that biological expectation and just turns it completely upside down.
He really does.
When you look at No Lucis, the bull is rendered with this astonishing, dense, heavy volume. The artist uses these deep, modulated grays and rich blacks that give the animal an undeniable, almost gravitational weight.
You can almost feel the heat and the breath of the animal when you look at it.
Yes, exactly. And drawn within the dark, heavy embrace of this massive bull is a young girl, rendered with these incredibly soft, vulnerable lines. But the matador, he has been stripped of every ounce of that traditional brilliance.
Every single ounce. The gold, the sequins, the sharp tailoring, all of it is just gone.
It's completely erased.
The matador is relegated to the far background. He's reduced to a blurred white, practically transparent ghost. The perpetrator of the violence is completely denied his visual power.
Here's where it gets really interesting for me, though. This isn't just symbolic. It is a literal mechanical trick played on tines.
How so?
Well, because the matador is painted as a watery blur, devoid of any crisp edges or contrast, your eye literally slips off of him.
Oh, I see.
And you try to anchor your gaze on the human figure, but there's nothing for your retina to grab onto. So your gaze is physically deflected back to the center of the painting, back to that quiet, vulnerable embrace between the heavy bowl and the soft lines of the girl.
It's an incredible visual manipulation.
It really is.
Yeah.
But I have to ask, is erasing the bad guy a stroke of genius, or is it, I don't know, a bit of a cheat? Is the artist just spoon-feeding you a simplified, didactic lesson by refusing to paint the complex reality of the executioner?
That is the big question. And to answer it, we have to look at how Francisco de Goya handled this exact same subject in the late 18th and early 19th centuries.
Right, Goya's famous etchings.
Yeah, Goya's Tauromaquia print series is legendary. He was deeply horrified by the violence of his era, but his approach was the exact opposite of erasing the perpetrator.
He went all in.
He really did. Goya rendered the brutality, the blood, and the men committing the violence with terrifying, inescapable detail. He forced the viewer to look the violence directly in the face.
Yeah, and Picasso did the same thing with his Minotaur series later on. He leaned entirely into the muscle, the sweat, and the visceral, unavoidable conflict. He certainly didn't blur anything out.
No, he didn't. But if we connect this to the bigger picture, the modern context of violence changes the calculus entirely.
How so? Because violence is violence.
Right. Well, yes, but the source text makes a compelling argument that we just don't live in Goya's world anymore. In Goya's time, exposing brutal violence visually was a revelation. It was showing people a harsh truth they might not otherwise see up close.
Like photojournalism before cameras.
Exactly. But in the 21st century, violence has been utterly digested into an endless spectacle of mass consumption. We see it on the news, in movies, constantly on our phones.
We are totally desensitized to it.
We are. The text argues that today, if you give the executioner a face, if you paint the matador with anatomical virtuosity and dazzling detail, you accidentally exalt the exact system you are trying to critique. You end up hypnotizing the viewer all over again with the glamour of the action.
Oh, wow. So because we are so deeply conditioned to consume violence as high-definition entertainment, if you paint the matador beautifully, you're basically just making an action movie poster.
You feed the beast, yeah.
You feed the beast.
Exactly. So by turning the matador into a watery blur, the artist is delivering a calculated symbolic snub. It is the ultimate insult to a figure whose entire existence relies on being the center of attention.
It's like taking away his microphone.
Yes. The painting tells the matador, you are obsolete. Your violence doesn't even warrant the pigment it would take to paint your face.
I mean, I see the logic of the snub. I really do. But, and this is a big, but doesn't true artistic confrontation require looking the monster in the eye?
That's the counter argument, definitely.
Yeah, if you remove the focus from the perpetrator, don't you risk weakening the raw, visceral power that historical art possessed? Like, Goya's prints haunt you for weeks, precisely because the violence is unavoidable. It grabs you by the throat.
They are very hard to forget.
Right. And I worry that modern activism's tendency to kind of blur out the bad guys, to deplatform the perpetrator visually, might inadvertently soften the blow. It makes the critique feel a bit too safe, you know,
mm-hmm.
a little too sanitized.
I get why you'd say that. But that tension between a sanitized image and a confrontational one is actually resolved in the physical materials of the painting itself.
Wait, really? The physical materials?
Yes. The deliberate choice to deny the viewer a comfortable spectacle goes far beyond just blurring out a figure. It is literally baked into the chemistry of the paint and the structure of the paper. It actually changes how your nervous system reacts to the image.
Okay, let's get into those materials then, because the mechanics here sound absolutely fascinating.
They really are.
When most people think of watercolor, they imagine, you know, smooth, flowing, highly transparent washes of color that just kind of glide beautifully across the page.
It's like a gentle landscape.
Exactly. But the technical sheet for No Looses reveals a completely different beast. The artist chose a 640-gram Arches paper.
Which is massive.
It is. If you haven't held this stuff, it is not normal paper. It is incredibly thick, dense, almost like a sculptural cotton cardboard.
Yeah, it's rugged.
Very. At a microscopic level, it has this heavy grain full of deep valleys and jagged peaks.
And onto that microscopic mountain range of paper, the artist applies Daniel Smith watercolors. Now, these specific paints are really famous in the art world for their extreme granulation.
Granulation meaning they don't mix smoothly.
Exactly. The pigment particles in these paints are literally heavy minerals. So when water hits the paper, the pigment doesn't just dissolve evenly into a smooth, pretty wash.
What does it do instead?
The heavy particles sink and settle aggressively into the deep valleys of the paper while leaving the high peaks completely bare and white.
Oh, wow. So the physical result is a texture that looks incredibly dry, arid, and almost scratchy. It looks tarched, kind of like a desert landscape.
That's a perfect description.
And the source material actually makes a brilliant connection here. It explicitly compares the traditional bullfight with its bright flashing colors, its deafening noise, its constant motion to an archaic version of the modern infinite scroll algorithm.
Yeah, the bullfight is framed as this highly sophisticated system of stimulation. It is essentially an algorithm meticulously designed over centuries to capture, hold, and monetize human attention through the display of real suffering.
It's the original doom scroll.
The original dopamine hit of dramatic high-stakes violence, exactly.
To understand how the painting fights this, we have to look a bit at the psychology of aesthetics. The human eye and brain naturally seek out fluid lines, recognizable patterns, and smooth transitions because processing those things is easy.
Right, it doesn't take much effort.
Exactly. It requires low cognitive load, and the brain rewards you with a tiny release of dopamine. That is exactly why we love scrolling through sleek, beautiful images on our phones.
And this is where the materials come back in. The arid, scratchy texture of the watercolor acts as a deliberate visual short circuit to that exact dopamine loop.
A short circuit. That makes so much sense.
Right. Visual friction, like looking at TV static, or the deeply granulated, uneven pigment on this heavy paper, forces the brain's analytical center to kick into gear. It literally overrides the pleasure center.
Because it's harder to look at.
Yes. By leaving parts of that thick paper unpainted and dry, the painting aggressively denies the viewer the fluid, easy consumption of a polished image. It forces you to stop scrolling, essentially. You have to slow down, feel the visual friction, and just sit with the stark vulnerability of the scene without the comfort of a slick aesthetic.
Okay, I understand the mechanism, and it's clever. But painting is, at its core, a visual medium.
Of course.
If you intentionally make the surface physically uncomfortable to look at, if you make the texture so dry that the eye constantly stumbles and gets irritated, don't you risk alienating the viewer entirely?
It's definitely a risk.
I mean, if it's too much work to look at, people will just look away. Can an aesthetic that actively repels the eye foster any kind of intimate dialogue? Or does it just push the audience out of the room before the conversation even starts?
That is the ultimate gamble of activist art. And this strategy, pushing the viewer away aesthetically to force an intellectual reckoning, brings this deep dive to its final and perhaps most difficult tension.
Which is?
It is the clash between the inherent mystery of art and the rigid demands of philosophical instruction.
Ah, Right, because this painting doesn't just hang quietly on a wall, leaving you to guess what it means.
Not at all.
The source material frames no looses with incredibly dense, discursive text. You might be listening to this and wondering why a watercolor of a bull needs a philosophical manual attached to it.
It's a valid question.
Well, the analysis explicitly claims that this work dismantles the quote-unquote neoliberal narrative. Now, just to be very clear to you listening, we are simply exploring the analytical framework that the artist and the critics are using here.
Right. We are just reporting their perspective.
Exactly. We aren't endorsing the idea that neoliberalism turns everything into entertainment or making any political stance. Yeah. We have to understand the mechanism they are pointing to in the text to understand the art.
Yes. And the mechanism they are critiquing is the economic and cultural system that assigns a price tag and entertainment value to absolutely everything, including suffering and death.
Which they tie directly to the bull ring.
Exactly. The text argues that the bullfight is the ultimate historical distillation of this neoliberal impulse, turning a living creature's pain into a ticketed, glamorous spectacle. And the text admits something pretty astonishing for an art critique, actually.
What's that?
It proudly states that the painting deliberately sacrifices traditional anatomical virtuosity in favor of, quote, symbolic clarity.
Symbolic clarity.
Mm-hmm.
Which brings us to the real debate over the soul of art itself, because historically the greatest art possesses polysemy.
Polysemy meaning it has a multiplicity of meanings.
Exactly. A great painting acts as a mirror. It can mean 10 different things to 10 different people, depending on what they bring to it when they look at it. The best art usually refuses to give you straight answers. Instead, it provides you with much better questions.
But this raises an important question. Does that still work today? The source material fundamentally challenges that classical idea in the face of systemic violence.
How so?
The argument is that when you are confronting a deeply institutionalized violent system, leaving room for interpretation isn't a sign of artistic sophistication. They argue it is a form of moral cowardice.
Oh, wow. Moral cowardice.
Yes. You cannot dismantle a centuries-old tradition of cruelty with a subtle, ambiguous whisper. A viable ethical future requires a strict, undeniable stance. The art must instruct.
So what does this all mean for the viewer? Because this is where I struggle the most with this approach.
It can be heavy-handed.
Very. If I have to read a massive block of critical text to understand that a blurry matador equals a symbolic snub against neoliberalism, or that the scratchy texture of the paper is supposed to be a short circuit to my attention algorithm, the painting stops feeling like an invitation to explore.
It feels like a lecture.
Exactly. It feels like a strict moral directive. It's like turning a complex, beautiful landscape painting into a giant red stop sign.
That's a great analogy.
Thanks. I mean, sure, if you paint a stop sign, everyone gets the message to halt. The communication is 100% effective. But nobody stops to admire the subtle shades of red on a stop sign.
Right. The aesthetic mystery is gone.
By trying to replace traditional philosophy by leading the viewer by the hand down such a narrow ideological path, doesn't the instruction essentially strangle the observation?
It is the eternal tug of war between art as an open-ended exploration and art as a vehicle for urgent social change. If the house is on fire, you don't paint a mysterious, ambiguous picture of smoke. You paint a clear map to the exit.
That's fair.
Whether you side with the urgent need for ethical clarity or you mourn the loss of artistic ambiguity, it is undeniable that this piece succeeds in forcing a profound reevaluation of what we accept as tradition. It forces us to ask why we demand that violence be beautifully packaged and what it means when an artist flatly refuses to play along with that expectation.
And that really is the brilliant, enduring tension of No Looses. It stands as a brave, ethically coherent counterimage to centuries of high-definition spectacle, even if it has to sacrifice some of its aesthetic mystery to ensure its message is heard loud and clear.
Exactly.
But the beauty of a deep dive like this is that you do not have to just accept our analysis or the source text analysis. We highly encourage you to go view the painting yourself.
Yes, you really need to see it.
You can find the high-resolution image at artcoloragua.com. That is artcolor-agua.com. Zoom in on it. Examine the heavy valleys of that 640-gram paper. Look at how the matador physically fades into the background and form your own judgment on whether the visual friction actually works for you.
Experience that deliberate, arid discomfort firsthand. See if your eye slips off the matador as designed and decide for yourself if the moral message overrides the medium or if they work together.
As we wrap up, I want to leave you with one final thought to mull over, kind of expanding on the core mechanism we've explored today.
I love these final thoughts.
Think about that opening idea, the painting refusing to be a comfortable window. If we actively took the suit of lights off the everyday traditions in our own lives.
Oh, that's interesting.
If we stripped away the glittering, highly produced, frictionless aesthetics of how we consume our daily media, our fast food, or our endless scrolling streams of digital entertainment, what uncomfortable raw truths would be left standing there in the dark, demanding that we finally pay attention?
That is an essential question for absolutely anyone navigating the modern spectacle.
Until next time, keep looking deeper.